Hello and welcome everybody to this evening's event. We will be discussing Mathilde Rosina's book on the criminalization of irregular migration in Europe. This is an event hosted by the European Institute. My name is Eiko Thielemann. I'm an associate professor in political science and public policy. I'm also the director of the MSc in International Migration and Public Policy here at LSE. I'm delighted to be chairing this event today and delighted to welcome our speakers, Mathilde Rosina and Natasha Zaun. And before I go into the issues around criminalization and invite our speakers to come in, I wanted to announce a few housekeeping rules. For those Twitter users in the audience, the hashtag for today's event is hashtag LSE Migration. The event is being recorded and is planned to be made available as a podcast, subject to no technical difficulties. Today's event will consist of a presentation from our book author, Mathilde, and our discussant, Natasha Zaun. We will then have some time for Q&As, I invite you to submit your questions that you might have or any comments in the Q&A function of your screen. I will then try and pose as many questions as I can to our speakers. If you would, it would be helpful if you could state your name and affiliation as you pose your questions. So the issues around the criminalization of migration are without any doubt on the top of the political agenda. Here in the UK, of course, we don't need to look any further than the Nationality and Borders Act that is going through Parliament as we speak. Obviously, an important part of the bill is basically the government's intention to create two different routes for asylum seekers, a regular and an irregular group, basically making the majority of asylum seekers here in the UK potentially subject to criminal proceedings. Of course, tonight we will discuss the criminalization of migration in a wider European context. Let me just introduce our two speakers. Dr. Mathilde Rosina is an LSE Fellow in International Migration here at the European Institute. Her research focuses on the political economy of international migration. And our discussant is Dr. Natasha Zaun, Assistant Professor in Migration Studies, also here at the European Institute. And I'm now delighted to hand over to Mathilde to begin her presentation. Mathilde, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Eiko, for your kind introduction, and to all of you for being here despite the very nice weather. So I will, can I just check that you can see my screen? Yes, perfect. So as Eiko was mentioning, I will present today my book that was just released, which is on the criminalization of irregular migration in Europe. And first of all, I want to start by really outlining what I mean by criminalization, because this word has been used in different, is used in different settings. So when I speak about criminalization, I take a narrow definition and I refer to it as the adoption of criminal sanctions against irregular migration. So basically, most EU member states have the so-called, have in place a crime of irregular migration. So you can see here a map of the member states adopting either having either a crime of irregular entry or stay. And what this means is that people who enter irregularly or stay in a country without the valid documents or necessary documents can be subject to criminal sanctions such as fines or even imprisonment. So in my book, I focus on two key EU member states, specifically Italy and France, to address the following key research questions. So the core question is really to what extent criminalization can succeed in deterring migration to the two states, to Italy and France, but also very importantly, what are the consequences of criminalizing irregular entry and stay, and who benefits from them? And although the analysis is on Italy and France, hopefully it can have relevance for countries beyond those two analyzed. Now, if we just consider here, as the first question says, I consider criminalization as an example of a deterrent strategy. So those strategies that really aim to discourage migration by increasing the costs associated to it. So in the case of criminalization, by, for instance, increasing, the sanctions foreseen for it. So if we go back to this slide for a second, as I said, I focus on Italy and France, and the two countries have very high sanctions in place for irregular migration. So on one hand, we have Italy, which foresees a fine of between 5,000 and 10,000 euro for anyone who enters or stays irregularly in the country. On the other hand, France foresees a slightly lower sanctions, which is roughly 3,700 euro, but also a 1 year imprisonment. So we see different kinds of sanctions, but in both countries quite severe. So my study is inserted in the, from a theoretical viewpoint, the study is inserted in the international political economy debate concerning the role of the state in migration governance, and to what extent the state is still the key actor in really governing migration, migratory flows, or whether its role is declining in light of increasing globalization. So here the debate is articulated among three main schools of thought. That is, on one hand, realist scholars who tend to argue that the state is still plays a key role and can still control entries and exits from its territories. This view, however, is contested by the other two schools of thought. So on one hand, we have liberal internationalists who actually view legal and institutional factors, like, for instance, courts or supranational institutions, as limiting the capacity of the state to control migration. So they act as a mediator against restrictive measures in a way. And on the other hand, we have transnationalist authors who actually view migration as a structural phenomenon and therefore largely beyond states' control. So I aim to add to these discussions by focusing on criminalization and deterrence, as I mentioned earlier. And specifically, I do so by bringing in some evidence by another field, that is criminology. The reason being that these theories and this this literature has vastly expanded or vastly studied the way in which criminalization and deterrence work. And what they find is that in order for deterrence to be successful, actually there are a number of parameters that need to be met. Specifically, these include the certainty and to a lesser extent, the severity of the sanctions, but also how these are perceived by potential rule breakers. And finally, they consider the role of social costs. So the potential stigmatization of rule breakers or of migrants in our case, as a consequence of being criminalized and infringing a law. So in this context, the literature has often noted a gap between the stated goals and the actual outcomes of migration policies. And this is what is referred to as the policy gap hypothesis. No, this is a very influential hypothesis in the migration studies literature. However, I follow the approach taken by Zeika and De Haas, and specifically I focus not so much on the distance between the stated goals, so politicians' rhetoric and the actual effects, but rather on three different sets of policy gaps. And I will show you how. Basically, following Zeika and De Haas, I distinguish, first of all, the discursive gap, which is between the politician's rhetoric and how a law is written down on paper. So there could be a divergence there already. The second gap is the implementation gap, which could be between how the law is written down on paper and then how it is implemented. And finally, efficacy gaps actually look for or examine the actual effects of measures, also in relation to external factors after the implementation of a certain policy. So I arranged the organization of the empirical part for this presentation and in the book, following this threefold structure, building on discursive implementation and efficacy gaps. Now, before going into some of the findings of my research, I want to briefly mention the methods and sources that I use. And what I do is I carry out a policy evaluation of criminalization in the two member states, in Italy and France. And specifically, I assess a range of criteria which are derived from EU ex post policy evaluations. And these include the efficacy of the measure, so the extent to which it actually reached its stated goals, but also the efficiency. So in terms of the whether it was effective from a cost perspective, whether it was coherent in terms of national and supranational legislation, and whether it was sustainable in the long term. And finally, the last parameter is that of utility in terms of different actors and how they might benefit from the measure itself. So in this presentation, I will focus mainly on the first parameter, but in the book, I expand on the other ones as well. So in terms of the sources that I use, I did over 50 interviews with key stakeholders, and these included both politicians as well as local actors like police officers, judges, magistrates, and NGOs. And I conducted over 100 questionnaires with migrants in Italy and in France. And I also looked at, or I also examined data sets, official data sets concerning migration and the crime of migration, some of which were not previously released or made public. And I triangulate all this information together with secondary literature, as well as information from court rulings, national legislation, and further documents. So I triangulate these different sources in order to increase the validity of the findings. So what are the findings of my research? I will start from the discursive gaps. And here, I think it's very interesting because what I find is that the case is quite different in France and in Italy. So on one hand, in France, we see that the discursive gaps seem to have been quite limited in the sense that the crime of irregular migration, both the interviews and existing literature suggest that this was never very much politicized. It was never a taboo in France. But at the same time, the criminalization of migration actually, as we saw, includes both a fine and imprisonment. So we can characterize it as being rather severe. So in light of this leads me to argue that the gap seems rather limited. Now, this is not the case in Italy, where instead we see quite a substantial discursive gap. And indeed, criminalization had a very high salience in political debates. Criminalization in Italy was adopted in 2009, and it had been long advocated by the far right, and it was very much politicized. And indeed, when the norm was presented in 2008, it foresaw imprisonment as well. In the end, however, when it was written down and ratified, imprisonment was left aside and it only foresaw a fine. So we can already see here, in a way, a watering down of the measure between and a discursive gap between the rhetoric and the policy as written down on paper. Now, what I think is interesting, however, is that criminalization was also paralleled 1 month after its adoption by a regularization of roughly 300,000 migrants in Italy. And not only that, but it was also paralleled by a decrease in the number of controls on irregular work. So this was done intentionally by the Italian government in order to reduce the burden on local firms following the financial crisis. So what emerges here is a substantial gap, discursive gap. And I argue that this can be understood as a case of deliberate malintegration in which basically the government was aiming to simultaneously pursuing different interests or different goals. And specifically on one hand, trying to increase the perception of security, while on the other hand, however, avoid damaging those sectors of the economy that actually vastly rely on irregular foreign work. So we see a key role of politics in watering down the norm in the Italian case, which was not necessarily the case in France. Now, when we move on to the next gap, that is the implementation gap, actually the findings here are more similar for the two cases. And indeed, the implementation gap was substantial for both Italy and France. And what we see, for instance, starting with France, is that there was a widespread use of criminal custody, which is the first step of the criminal process. However, then there were very, very limited numbers of condemnations. So if we look at the picture here, at the image here, the solid yellow line is the number of registered infractions in France. And we can see that between 2006 and 2012, it was over 100,000 per year registered crimes or infractions. Whereas condemnations were actually are down here, it's the yellow dotted line, and it was on average below 3,000 per year in the same period, so much lower. Now, what I wish to highlight in the case of France is the role played by courts. And here it is specifically the role played by the French Supreme Court, but also by the European Court of Justice, because they played a key role in leading to the repeal of part of the norm, so the decriminalization of irregular stay, whereas irregular entry is still a crime in the country. So they played a key role there. Now, in the case of Italy, on the other hand, what we see is that implementation was still very limited, but this was due to not so much national, supranational courts, but rather the role of local actors. So here, a lot of the actors I interviewed, like police officers or judges, were telling me how they were just looking for ways to set aside those cases or turn a blind eye on those cases, really, to avoid implementing the procedures that they were supposed to implement. So this, we really see that was very much at the local level. Abstracting a little bit, however, we can see that both in the Italian and the French case, courts played a key role in limiting the implementation of the of criminalization. What this also tells us is that if you remember, I mentioned that certainty is a key parameter for deterrence to work. And so this was lacking both in the French and the Italian case. So what were the implications of this for the actual effects of the measure? When I turn to efficacy gaps, I find that criminalization emerged as ineffective both in Italy and in France. And first of all, so criminalization had two main goals, which was in both countries, which was first to decrease irregular migration, and second to increase expulsions or returns. It failed on both accounts. So concerning irregular migration, with migration being criminalized in Italy, landing still peaked at over 180,000 in 2016. We see the orange dotted area here. And France was consistently among the top five EU member states in terms of irregularly staying migrants between 2008 and 2018. So this, you can see the solid blue columns referring to regular stays in France. As far as returns are concerned, this didn't increase substantially either. And indeed, the proportion of condemnations that resulted in an actual expulsion was very low. This was about 3% in France between 2012 and 2016, and about 0.3% in Italy. So we are talking about very low proportions. Now, what I think is interesting is that criminalization was not only ineffective, but also counterproductive. And it was counterproductive in a number of ways. First of all, in Italy, it contributed to lengthening the parallel investigations against smugglers, which became longer as a result of migrants being investigated for the crime of irregular entry or stay. But it also by affecting migrants' criminal records, it made it harder for them to find a job in the regular economy, therefore increasing their marginalization. Now, why was criminalization ineffective? I think there are a number of reasons for this, but I will focus here on a couple. And if we take the micro level perspective, so if we relate this back to the criminological aspects that I was discussing earlier, well, first of all, we see that certainty was low. We saw that implementation was scarce, but also there is very little evidence that fines were ever paid back. I also find that possibly there was a scarcity of information by migrants themselves. And indeed, among the migrants that I interviewed, only 2% knew of criminalization in Italy, and none did in France. And finally, what I think is interesting is that some of the interviews revealed that being detained in Europe may not be seen as something that is, being detained in Europe is increasingly seen as normal. So in this way, it does not bear the stigma and the stigmatization that we saw criminological studies actually see as key for deterrence to succeed. Now, if we take a more macro level perspective, what we can argue is that the lack of effectiveness of criminalization actually can be understood as a result of the norm actually playing a marginal role when compared to the structural drivers of migration. And in particular, it neglects the, by only introducing the negative incentives, so the fines or imprisonment, it neglects the structural factors really at the origins of migration. And as an example, in the questionnaires, I asked the question on whether knowing the sanctions of irregular migration would make the respondent want to migrate in another way. And 70% of the respondents said no. So knowing the consequences or the sanctions against migration wouldn't make them want to change the way in which they migrated. Now, To wrap up, what I argue is that criminalization as a case of deterrence was not effective either in Italy or France in reducing migration or increasing expulsions or returns. Instead, it was counterproductive. However, it had a very strong symbolic and political dimension, which made it extremely hard to repeal. And indeed, in France, even though we had the repeal of part of the norm, actually this was paralleled by an increasing criminalization of other acts related to migration. And in Italy, despite widespread contestation of the norm is still in place. And even center-left governments haven't been able to change it, or have not changed it. So this symbolic and political dimensions have made it very hard to repeal the norm, thus contributed to what we could see as vicious cycles of irregularity stemming from greater marginalization and insecurity. Thank you.
Thank you, Matilda. Very clear, very succinct account of what is a very rich text, which I had a chance to look at already. For those of you who want to have that look, you will have seen in the chat, there's an opportunity to buy it and get a discount for it. So check out the chat for the details. Obviously, your summary also raises a number of interesting questions for a lot of us, I'm sure. To set us off on some of these questions, I'm happy to hand over to Natasha Tsaun, who has kindly agreed to act as the discussant of today's event. Natasha, over to you.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Aiko. This is a great book, and I can only recommend you all to read it if you haven't done so so far. So as Matilda has shown in your presentation, she's assessing the impact of criminalization on migratory movements. So is criminalization an effective deterrent of migration flows? And then also what's the impact of people and more on the impact on the migrants more generally and more widely? And in doing so, as we've seen, she really bridges debates in international political economy with criminology, which is quite innovative. And what I also find quite innovative is that she really brings in the perspectives of both policymakers and elites and migrants themselves. That's also something that we have very rarely, I think, in research. And I think that's really original. So, I have a couple of questions. So my first question would be, and that's something actually, Matilda, that you do in the book in the end, I've seen, but it would be nice to ask you again, what do you think are the main lessons that policymakers can draw from your book? Because obviously, this is research that is very relevant to policymaking as well. My second question, where I try to push you a little bit, is this is the big question, right? Like, what is the it relates to the question of what is the impact more generally of policy on migration and migratory movements? And of course, it's also really hard to assess because there's so many factors that can influence a migratory movement, like, for example, the situation in the sending countries and so on. So how are you ensuring that you're really measuring what you're measuring and that really what you assess? How can you be sure that it's really not the policies affecting this and it's other things? So and decreasing migration. Relatedly, could you also say a little bit about the representativeness of your survey, like the sample of the immigrants that you're talking to? Then another question that I would be curious to learn about, like what is the finding that you yourself found most surprising when doing the research? Next, which is also, I think, something that you do address in the book, is if these policies are really not effective at all, why do policymakers stick to them? Like, why are they in place? Shouldn't we have abolished them, or shouldn't they be abolished already? There are some countries that, what you showed, like in your graph, right, that don't have criminalization in place. So what are their arguments to not have them? Also, for example, you show there's a lot of various variants in Europe. And with regards to your two cases, do you have a hunch why France and Italy have such a different approach? Why they address this so differently? And then finally, just something that I found really interesting from your book, and there you discuss it a little bit, is that you say that, for example, in Italy, I think there's a difference between the perceived dimension of irregular migration and the actual dimension. And this is something when engaging with students, you can't be really, the numbers on irregular migration are always problematic. But students are usually quite surprised when they see how small the number of irregular migration in Italy still is, kind of in light of the debate. And also now, I think you showed that there were, in the presentation, there were 200,000 landings in 2016, which, I mean, it's perhaps a lot, but it's not like what we expect the dimension to be like from the political discourse. And so I wonder, could that also contribute perhaps to kind of the discursive gap and to like the discourse being kind of, yeah, about this kind of, we need to be so restrictive because yeah, we define this as such a big problem. I mean, then you have to do something. That was just something that was crossing my mind, but I found this also really, really interesting. Okay, and I think that's my questions. And I'm very curious to hear what you think.
Thanks, Natasha. That gives us plenty to kick off with. I think, Matilda, you mentioned in the book that there are two countries in Europe that have not gone down the route of criminalization. And I wonder whether you can out those and maybe reflect on why they are different to the rest of the bunch. Over to you, Matilda. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Aiko, and thanks, Natasha, for your kind comments and for the many questions. Some excellent questions. I hope I can do justice to them all. Maybe I can start from the last of the questions to link it to the first one a little bit, because you were mentioning misinformation. And I think it's a key issue, one of which I think is also a key aspect that we need to consider when analyzing or proposing policy solutions or policy lessons in a way to consider, that we have this huge gap between public perceptions and the actual numbers of migration. Just as an example, the literature stresses that the number of overstayers has been much higher than number of entries, perhaps until 2015, but that was not necessarily reflected in the in the public debate as much as landings were. So trying to go back to the to your questions, your first question was about the lessons for policymakers. And I think the first lesson is that criminalization is not working, but that it has detrimental effects. And not only that, but that it starts in a way what I see as a sort of a vicious cycle, you could say, of insecurity, in which you have more spiraling criminalization because of public demand for it, as you were saying. However, what I think is important to consider is that even perhaps beyond criminalization, measures of deterrence might also have an impact, if not in reducing migration, in shifting migratory flows more towards other routes, or more underground through substitution effects. So I think that's something that we need to consider when assessing the impact of policies. And this might detract from the how successful a policy could be. And I think that in order to avoid the drawbacks that I highlight concerning criminalization, a way forward would include opening more legal pathways, both for economic and non-economic migration. So both for humanitarian corridors for refugees, but also increasing quotas for economic migration. Now, in this context, I think you raised an excellent point concerning how to measure causality. And this is something I struggled with a little bit as well, and that I consider in the book, because as you say, it's not necessarily easy to identify the direct relationship. So I think an additional aspect is that with irregular migration, the figures are never completely accurate by definition as well. So in order to reduce any possible biases and to validate the findings, what I do is to really rely on a very broad range of sources and triangulate the different sources. So I started from the figures concerning migration and changes compared to changes in migration law. But then I triangulated this with the surveys that I did with, or the questionnaires that I did with the migrants, as well as the interviews that I did with the stakeholders. So to bring in the different perspectives. And I think it's the survey is not representative. It was only about 100 migrants that I interviewed, but still I think it's very interesting because it brings in their own viewpoint into this broader framework. And as I said, 70% of them, of those who answered, actually stated that it wouldn't really have had any impact knowing the different sanctions. And the second, let's say, measure that I take in order to reduce any possible biases is to look at a range of criteria to assess effectiveness, the five criteria that I mentioned in the presentation, based on EU evaluation projects. Moving on, your next question was about what I found most surprising. And I have to say, well, there were a couple of things that I found surprising. Maybe I can spell out two in particular. And the first one was that there was a significant difference between the interviews that I carried out in Italy and in France in terms of the approach, interviews with local actors like police officers or judges in terms of the approach. So in Italy, they tended to have a much more humane approach in a way, as opposed to those in France, which tended to see migration more as a security issue. So this might be related to the closer contact, really, to the migrants themselves, but it's something that I wasn't expecting and that I found interesting. And the second aspect concerns the migrants themselves and the way they get information, because out of the surveys, what emerged was that only 12% of them got information about migration from the internet. And this, I guess, is consistent with the literature stressing the role of networks. And that's what I argue. But I still expected that the internet would play somewhat of a greater role. So these are two of the findings from the empirical research that I carried out that I think were interesting or surprising for me. Now, if I can move on to your next question, it was about why, basically, even though these measures have been shown to be ineffective, why do we still have them? And well, I think I would very much relate this to the discursive dimension of criminalization. And in a way, we can see it as addressing two different audiences. On one hand, migrants, on the other hand, the domestic public. Now, in the case of criminalization, the domestic public took precedence, took priority for the politicians, and they were unable to repeal the law, basically. This was, it's interesting because in Italy, actually, there was a survey carried out among the voters of the Five Star Movement, which is a populist party, and they actually turned out to be in favor of removing the crime of irregular migration. So perhaps the people were ready to accept that, but the politicians weren't. So, If I now move on, yes, and you asked me about the two countries that do not adopt criminalization, so that's Portugal and Malta, and it's the only two countries. All the other countries actually do have criminalization in place, either of entry or stay, or both, and here in the UK, as Aiko mentioned, they are proposing to increase the sanctions, actually, so it's on the rise, I would argue. And just on the final question, why was it different in Italy and France? So perhaps this could be related to the different migration systems in the two countries. So the literature has often noted a a very significant policy gap, especially in Southern European countries, where migration policies are said to be very strict, but then the enforcement is much, much laxer in a way, as compared to more Northern European countries. And this could also be related to the greater role of the underground economy in Italy as opposed to in France. So I hope I have answered all of your questions.
Perfect. Thanks, Matilda, for that first round. Let me perhaps just pick up on what you said about, I guess, possible alternatives. We had a question from Waltraud Schelkle, who asks, who's at here at the European Institute, who asks, how could governments decriminalize if they listen to your research findings? Has any government of a rich democracy ever tried? So in a way, it goes back to the question of what can we also learn from the outliers, right? You mentioned Portugal, you mentioned Malta. Obviously, you talked a little bit in your presentation about the creation of legal entry routes, but I wonder whether you could perhaps expand a little bit on that idea of alternatives. What could be done differently if one didn't want to go down the route of criminalization?
Thank you. That's a very good question. So I think first of all, in terms of how could they decriminalize, very specifically by removing the crime of irregular migration, right? So making it not a crime, so not addressed by criminal sanctions. Now, in this context, France has, I wouldn't say tried, but in a way they have some experience with decriminalization insofar as in 2012, they decriminalized irregular stay. However, this, I would say, was not necessarily successful in the sense that they also increased parallel crimes. So they introduced new crimes, such as the crime of staying after a certain measure, after an expulsion order was issued. So ultimately, criminalization was still very much in place. But I think that if legal pathways were opened or increased, this would very much reduce the irregular side of migration. So it would increase the legal movements and reduce the need for the reliance of smuggling, for instance, to enter or to stay and on the underground economy. So in that sense, I think that I would argue that, and in a way there are arguments concerning also the need of European economies, the reliance of European economies on migrants. For instance, this emerged as very evident during the COVID pandemic, when there were, for instance, employers flying in migrants because of the need for them. So if this was regularized, it would give a chance also to receiving societies to know, to have better control and to reduce the irregular side, not only associated to migration, but also to the underground economy that then involves them once they are there.
Thanks, Matilda. I've got a follow-up from Waltraud, which clarifies that she was particularly interested in kind of the political dimension and the entrapment aspect. And if I could link this also with, you mentioned just the COVID context, and we have a question from Kosha, a future LSE student, who asks about what obligations states more generally have towards irregular migrants, in particular when it comes, for example, to the vaccination of irregular migrants in the context of the ongoing pandemic. So maybe you can take that as the next question to address.
Thank you. Concerning the first question, how to decriminalize from a political viewpoint, I think this goes back to what Natasha was saying. That is something that I mentioned also in the conclusion of the book, that is to say that we have substantial misinformation today in European countries. And we have surveys that show that the public vastly overestimates the number of migrants present on in their own countries, for instance. So I think that decriminalization would need to be paralleled by a strategy to inform the domestic public. So there is a lot of talk about information campaigns for the migrants, but maybe in a way, maybe they should be for the public as well, to really, show, first of all, the need, as I said earlier, for migrants' work, but also show the consequences that not doing so could have. And so I think that would need to be paralleled, to go in parallel with the political decriminalization of migration. Yes, and concerning the COVID case, in terms of COVID, well, what we saw with Italy was that during the COVID pandemic, they launched a regularization scheme. As I was saying earlier, they launched the regularization scheme, very much driven based on research that I'm conducting together with ICO on the needs for the employers who actively asked for these measures in order to have workers. And I have to say about the vaccination needs and other specific obligations, I have to look into that. I'm happy to, if you want to email me, to have a conversation about that.
Perfect. Thank you. There are a couple of questions that kind of relate to the themes around the political economy literature. Vegard Valberg, if I pronounced the name correctly, asks about the relevance of the varieties of capitalism debate to your findings, and whether, types of kind of liberal versus market economies or social democratic countries could be expected to respond differently to irregular migrants, and whether that could be kind of an added dimension to the analytical puzzle that you pose. So why don't you take that one?
Yes, thank you very much. I think that's a very interesting question that I have not discussed in the book, but it's something I would like to look more into, certainly in the future. But I have to say, I have not considered that yet.
I wonder whether I could follow up with a question of my own on this. So at the end of your book, when you talk about alternatives to the criminalization of irregular migration policies, you talk on the one hand about the creation of legal entry routes, and I think that's a very kind of persuasive and often made claim and call. But you also talk about potentially the need to, and let me just see to get that right, the need to strengthen the enforcement of labor control measures. And I presume you're talking here about the need to, engage with the phenomenon of the black market or the gray market in countries and like Italy and so on. But I guess the question that one could ask is whether, in a way that might just shift the problem, right? From, I guess, the deterrence of migrants to come to the country to perhaps, I guess, deterring them from entering the labor market or creating rules to keep them out of the legal right to work. And so I wonder whether you could maybe elaborate a little bit on that aspect, which I guess again goes to the core about of, I guess, labor market needs and the relationship to, I guess, migrants, legal and irregular, in different economies of Europe.
Thank you, Aiko. Sure. So, well, I think it's related to, when I suggest the enforcement of stricter labor control measure, for instance, as I said earlier, right, in 2009, these were reduced. So I think the key problem here is that very often the underground economy has been found to be a pull factor for migration itself. So studies by Raineri as well as others show that the southern European countries tend to be more attractive for migrants as opposed to northern European countries, for instance, because of the greater facility with which they can find employment there in the underground economy. So I think because of that reason, it's particularly important. And let me be clear, of course, underground economy that is not created by the migrants, but pre-exists, right, in those systems. Now, I think that with greater enforcement, it would need to go together with the greater enforcement of labor control would need to go together with the enforcement of labor control for citizens. So rather than only for migrants. So having more controls on the irregular employment and having more enforcement of those controls, basically. So if they were done in parallel, I don't think it would necessarily work out against migrants' possibilities of employment. And also, I think it's important to recall that with what may be a greater possibility of employment, actually very often also come up issues of exploitation. And so it's something that needs to be addressed.
Thank you. We have a very topical question from Anthony Valian, a LSE alumni, and he basically raises the issues around irregular migration and refugees. In my introduction, I talked about, I guess, regular and irregular routes, right, for protection seekers. And Anthony is asking, are you aware of any links between the number a country takes, so that's kind of refugee resettlement, and the discourse and criminalization of irregular migrants and asylum seekers? So here, I guess, is the question is about the relationship between, I guess, legal routes or regular routes, as the UK government is trying to call it, and I guess the control of those asylum seekers who are deemed to come through, I guess, less regular access routes.
Sure. So in a way, if those who take more refugees then are also stricter on irregular migration. I think that's a very interesting question. What I can say is that the UNHCR actually shows, if you go on the UNHCR website, they show that the need for resettlement is actually much, much higher than what is currently done by states. So I think states currently resettle about 4% of the overall need for resettlement globally. So it is very low, and most refugees are in neighboring countries, tend to be neighboring countries, most of them in the Middle East, for instance. In that sense, it is very low. And I think also in terms, even beyond refugees and humanitarian corridors, which Yes, even beyond humanitarian corridors, quotas have tended to decrease in recent years. So I think that's the second aspect to keep in mind, that they should also increase in parallel.
Thank you. A question from Nina Vulajavi, our colleague here in the European Institute. She asks, you mentioned the counter effects of criminalization of entry and stay. Could you talk more about them? What kind of financial costs do these cause to receiving states?
Yes, thanks, Nina. So in terms of the cost of criminalization, criminalization does have a number of counterproductive effects in terms of cost, I think. And that is for a number of reasons. First of all, it causes the duplication of processes and procedures. So if you take Italy, for instance, because of basically, procedurally, you need to process migrants both on the administrative side, leading to apprehension and expulsion, but also on the criminal side. So these two leading to the fine. So these two processes go in parallel. And as you can imagine, this brings to an overwhelming of the public offices and an increase in the costs for them. So that's also part of the reason why many of them try to just set aside those cases, as I said. In the case of France, this here the cost would be even higher, actually, because what the law foresees is that you have imprisonment for 1 year, and then at the end of imprisonment, you have expulsion. So you would need to sum those two costs, basically. And imprisonment is about 100 euro per day, more or less, and expulsions tend to be very costly. So even from a cost effectiveness perspective, it is not really a rational choice, I would say. And this is, one could argue that fines paid back could make up for revenues for the state in a way, but there is no data showing that these fines are actually paid. And indeed, if we think about the migrants, they're often in situations of very little availability, financial availability. So most of the interviewees were of the opinion that these fines are never paid.
Thanks, Mathilde. I'm looking at the clock here. I think we have time maybe for one final question. A former student, Teodora Marinescu, I remember Teodora, hello.
Hi,
asks whether there were any patterns in the responses of those who said that they would have migrated even if they had known about the consequences of criminalization. So patterns in terms of country of origin, and whether that might tell us something about kind of the kind of risks that migrants are, I guess, trying to escape from. So if you could answer that in 30 or 45 seconds, that would be great, Mathilde.
Okay, absolutely. So I will try to be quick. Indeed, a lot of the interviewees were of the opinion that the effectiveness of deterrence might, to a certain extent, depend on the countries of origin and the situation in which migrants found themselves. I have not looked at the different countries of origin of the migrants answering this. However, I do have the data, so I'm happy to go back to that, and we can be in touch by email, because that's something very interesting that I can easily look at.
Thank you very much, Mathilde. Thank you, Natasha, for your role as discussant, and thank you for everybody who attended here and asked questions and contributed to this event. You will have seen the details for how you can get hold of Mathilde's book, which I warmly recommend. And let me thank you all again. And I hope that we will see you at some of our future events in due course. All the best, have a very good evening, and goodbye for now.
Thank you, Aiko, and thanks everyone.
Thank you.